Ordinarily, we'd jump to another scene, but we've only got the zombies till 7. Well, hey, folks, how you doing? This is Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour right here on Sunsounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our first story comes from the Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine, written by Lauren D. Estelman, and it's called Tarzan Must Die. Jagged rows of beet plants, interrupted randomly by mounds of dry earth dug up by some subterranean rodent, form stumps of blackened leaves, each as stunted as its neighbor, as if they'd been allowed to grow to a predetermined height and then blighted according to plan. Valentino thought that plot of land, 2 miles outside Oxnard, the only 12 acres of worthless real estate in all of Southern California. It stood to reason that Albatross Films had chosen the location to shoot its latest direct-to-video feature. Darian Blix's trailer squatted there on squash tires, its paint broken down to chalk, duct tape peeling away from the cracked windows. It might have sprung up along with the doomed plants to hunker under the weight of the heat and drought, not daring to breathe until the crisis passed. The garish yellow star painted on the door struck the visitor as a deliberate smirk. The door swung open abruptly on the knock. He stepped back to avoid collision.
Mr. Valentino?
No, just Valentino. Mr. Bix?
Well, just Bix, since we're friends.
Was there a sneer to his tone? The film archivist couldn't tell. As a child, the actor had been known for the sardonic quality of his lines. Now, he just sounded tired. But his grip, when he bent to shake his visitor's hand, was firm.
I can give you 20 minutes. On this shoot, that's the same as an overnight wrap. The crane's acting up again. Ordinarily, we'd jump to another scene, but we've only got the zombies till 7. They've got a night shoot on Sci-Fi.
He indicated a group of emaciated-looking extras seated at a picnic table 100 yards away, dressed in loincloths and the occasional elaborate headdress. The production's technical crew bustled about the base of a dormant camera crane nearby. Bix was 30, but could pass for 15 years older. He was balding, and his bathrobe hung open, exposing a sunken chest and a slight paunch with muscles painted on. 20 years ago, he starred in King Brat, a sitcom about a precocious child adopted by a royal family exiled from a mythical European principality. Years of drugs and cut-rate therapy to ease the abused childhood had taken their toll. Valentino stepped aboard and stopped in his tracks. The trailer's walls were hung with original movie posters advertising classic Tarzan films, and every horizontal surface held stacks of Edgar Rice Burroughs' novels, early edition from the looks of them, in tattered dust jackets. Spears leaned in corners, and the moth-eaten head of a lion glared through glass eyes from the paneling above the single bed.
"Well, it looks like Johnny Weissmuller's rec room," he said.
"It's the collection of a lifetime," Bix said. "What's left of it? I got to be better known at all the studio auctions than I was on TV. I smuggled these last pieces here to hide them from the IRS. You won't snitch."
"That's between you and the tax man. I heard you were an enthusiast. Is that how you got this part?"
"That's why I read for it. 10 other washed-up actors turned it down. Here's why."
He scooped a dog-eared typescript off the top of a stack and threw it at his guest, who looked at the title page. "Tarzan versus the Zulu Zombies, a screenplay by Alan Smithy." The byline was the traditional nom de plume of a hack, ashamed of his work. Valentino gave it back without turning the page.
So much for the preliminaries. My department secretary said you have something else to show me.
Bring the money.
Valentino displayed a checkbook and returned it to the inside breast pocket. Bix nodded, opened a drawer in a built-in chest, and handed him a reel of film. From the same drawer, he drew a chrome-plated revolver and laid it on the copy of Tarzan and the Slave Girl, a movie tie-in with a photo of Lex Barker on the cover. He rested his hand on the gun.
Nothing personal, chum. When you've been rolled as often as me, you get suspicious. I don't run as fast as I used to. They undercrank my action scenes so I look like Secretariat.
Valentino carried the reel to a window, being careful not to turn his back on his armed host, unspooled a foot and a half of film and held it up to the light. Past the blank frames where the film was fed into the projector. The action started with shaggy-haired, barrel-chested Elmo Lincoln wearing only a lion skin attached to one shoulder, swinging from a vine and then wrestling a giant gorilla. It was in remarkable condition for a film shot on silver nitrate stock in 1918. This, too, he returned, handling it with a great deal more care than Tarzan versus the Zulu Zombies.
It isn't really a lost film, he said. It's one of the few survivors of the era, and from what I can see, this is only the last reel. What are you offering UCLA we don't already have?
Here's the can. Bix exchanged the reel for a flat tarnished canister he took from the drawer and handed it over. The title, Tarzan of the Apes, was stenciled on the lid along with the year and production number in faded black ink, with an almost invisible addendum penciled below, TRT, 58 minutes, 21 seconds. The official total running time is 55 minutes. Valentino felt himself starting to vibrate like a man's palm itching when he's about to come into money. He told himself it was superstition and kept his composure.
Still is, said Bix. Apparently the cameraman didn't want to stop cranking after Scott Sidney. The director yelled cut. He shot 3 minutes and changed behind the scene. The footage is still in negative, spliced to the end. There was no reason to strike a positive of a bunch of actors and crews horsing around on the set. DVD extras were still 100 years away.
It's hilarious, he went on. A crew member dumped a barrel of rainwater over Lincoln's head to celebrate the wrap. Lincoln put him into a headlock. Tarzan versus the Teamsters.
How did you come by it? Valentino wished Kyle Broadhead, his boss and mentor, were present to admire the calmness of his tone. Newly discovered raw footage of a cinema milestone? His heart was beating hard enough to bruise a rib.
A state auction in Fresno, 10 years ago. I saw it advertised online and gave it a whirl. I had time to kill between court dates. The man's daughter didn't know what she had. Neither did anyone else. I was the only bidder on a box of junk. I kept the reel and left the rest behind. She said she found it in the back of the old man's closet when she was digging out a suit to bury him in. All she knew about his early life was he rode the rods all over the country during the Depression. Maybe he scrounged it out of an ash can behind one of the Pioneer studios. The old moguls weren't exactly curators. When they ran out of storage room, they just sold the oldest stuff for scrap or just dumped it.
I know that all too well. Do you recall the man's name?
The actor shook his head.
Nah, too many pills, too many stretches in the can. Is it important?
Probably not. Sometimes there's a question of intellectual property, but this one went into the public domain long ago. I'm just always curious about how these things wound their way round to me, through many pair of hands.
What are you asking?
$10.
Dr. Darian Bix, Valentino said.
Bix beamed, breaking his face into creases, each one attributable to some old tragedy. Take your time, he said. Live with it a moment. Can't you see it on the restaurant reservation? One of those ritzy places booked up a year in advance?
Just to be straight, you're offering to trade Tarzan of the Apes to my department in return for an honorary UCLA doctorate.
Yeah, plus $10. Call it a chump tax. I could peddle it to Supernova for 1,000 times that, but I'd just blow it on Iranian heroin. A PhD is forever. It won't spend.
King Brat seemed to have done his research. Mention of either Supernova International or Mark David Turkus, its founder and CEO, could be calculated to trigger instant panic in a poor academician competing with such deep pockets for the same prizes. Valentino felt his poker face slipping. He shored it up.
Well, I don't have the authority to give out academic honors. That's another department with entirely different priorities.
It wouldn't be likely to bend its rules in return for 3 minutes of celluloid.
Well, those are my terms.
Had Bix spoken those same 5 words in a different tone, the archivist would have thanked him for the offer and wished him luck with Turkus. But the actor's voice had cracked in the middle, as if it were going through adolescent change, and the expression on his face was impossible to interpret as anything other than hopeful desperation. Valentino had the disturbing feeling that he alone represented a poor sinner's last chance to turn his life around. A rap on the door shook him out of his reverie.
"Grain's fixed, Darian," said a voice. "Lou says shake a leg before it breaks down again. Tell Lou to stick his leg in his mouth and swallow. I'll be there in a minute."
Bix's gaze remained on his guest. Valentino said, "Well, I'll talk to my supervisor. He'll know what this property is worth, and he's bilingual in terms of region speak. He might be able to bring them around, but I can't make any promises." He hesitated. "Is a check all right for the deposit? I came without cash. Frankly, I thought it would cost more if we came to an agreement."
Bix shrugged. Valentino made out the check, scribbled 1918 on the production number on the memo line, and handed it over.
"The canceled check will be my receipt. Meanwhile, I'd place that reel under lock and key." Bix put the check in a bathrobe pocket. His smile this time was almost childlike, a throwback to the charming Tyke of 10.
"Believe me, with this crew, it's safe. The director sells tires full-time, and his AD's a librarian. There isn't a person in this beet patch paradise who knows Elmo Lincoln from Tickle Me Elmo. Excuse me while I get into character."
He shed his bathrobe, hitched up his loincloth, and cut loose with his Lord of the Jungle battle cry. Hearing it, Valentino decided that was the thing that had nailed the audition. Kyle Broadhead tamped down the only ounce of tobacco in use on the entire UCLA campus and applied a match. The ball of his thumb was scorched many times over because of his impatience with waiting for the pipe to cool. That attitude extended to his uncombed and unshorn gray hair and layers of ash on his sweater.
3 minutes, he said when he had the embers puffed into life. He shook out the flame and blew smoke at the nicotine stain on his office ceiling.
And 21 seconds, Valentino finished, a yard of film that in 107 years has never been seen in public.
Like the inferior nasal concha of Melanorosaurus, lost since the Triassic. And who cares apart from a handful of paleontologists gathered in their parents' basements?
All with PhD, Kyle.
Not likely to sway the Board of Regents, but I've still got some goodwill left over from that donation I swindled from a plastic surgeon at the last alumni dinner. I was hoping to trade it to the university press for an advance on my book. However, a chapter on Tarzan of the Apes might swing the deal. How about a bite to eat? You're buying.
Valentino had stopped at In-N-Out on his way back from Oxnard, but it was late and they were the only ones still at work in the old power plant where Broadhead tortured his film studies pupils outside class. Even Ruth, the department secretary and a fixture since Nixon, had gone home, or to the stone sarcophagus in the attic, where Broadhead swore she slept. Fanta, his child bride, was attending a legal seminar in San Francisco, and there was nothing waiting for the old man but a frozen dinner and an empty house. Valentino agreed. A man was standing in the hall outside the office. He was very tall and broad-shouldered, in a brown suit with western lapels and a bolo tie, closing the collar of his shirt. His clean-shaven face was burned as dark as red as clay.
"Is one of you gentlemen Valentino?" He had a deep, rumbling voice.
Valentino identified himself, and the man showed him a leather folder with a gold star pinned to it.
"Clarence Owl, I'm a detective lieutenant with the Ventura County Sheriff's Department. You know a man named Darian Bix?"
It wasn't phrased as a question.
"Yeah, so we met today. Is he in trouble?"
What time did you leave him?
A little after 5, I think.
May I ask what?
Was he alive?
Lieutenant Owl said it wouldn't be necessary for Broadhead to join them, but didn't argue when the latter insisted. The professor strapped himself into the back seat of a late model Mercury, and Valentino rode up front with the driver. The lights of West Hollywood slid past at a couple of miles above the speed limit.
"Nobody's accusing you of anything," Owl said. "As I understand it, this Bix was an addict. It's a simple overdose. He went back to his trailer after the camera crane broke down for like the 1,000th time and didn't respond when the assistant director knocked on his door to tell him it was fixed. The director got mad. Apparently it wasn't the first time his star had caused a delay and ordered a stagehand to break in. They found Bix on the floor, already getting cold."
"Then why the third degree?" said Broadhead.
"Oh, it's hardly that, and by the way, no one called it that since Dragnet."
The lieutenant's tone was edgy. He was already losing patience with his uninvited guest.
"We found a check in the trailer signed by Valentino with today's date. The assistant director says the deceased was locked up inside with somebody for 15 minutes. Nobody in the cast and crew was ever allowed inside, and he never had visitors. That figured him being a user. Probably didn't want anybody messing with his stash. We found some fentanyl rolled up in a sock. Tracing the name on the check was routine. I went to your place first," he told Valentino. "The movie theater, UCLA, was next."
Valentino said, "I told you what we discussed. I don't see why we have to go back to Oxnard."
"That should be the motto on the city limit sign," said the man in back.
Owl ignored the interjection.
"Your story checks to up to a point. Those posters and things help bear it out, but since you're the first visitor to have seen it all, maybe you can take a look and tell me if anything else is missing."
"Anything else?" both civilians spoke at the same time.
"My partner and I made a pretty thorough search of the place for any first pass. We didn't come across any reels of film."
Night, and the hard white glare of arc lights actually improved the look of the Tarzan set. The crew members milling about, the general air of excitement, and even the stuttering red and blue strobes of a quartet of official vehicles gave it the appearance of a busy motion picture production, like the dozens that took place in the Los Angeles area every day of the year. It might have been an A-feature shot on location and not a shoestring operation trying to make an unsuccessful beet farm look like the Serengeti. Owl led his companions to a trim young black woman in conversation with a fat man in front of the trailer. She wore tailored slacks and a blazer over a printed blouse.
"My partner, Sergeant Thorpe," he introduced the others. "Let's 86 the sergeant," she said, taking each of their hands in a firm, friendly grip. She had fine white teeth made for smiling and reddish-brown hair fixed with a gold clip at one temple to keep it out of her eyes. People look around for a weightlifter with a mustache. "I'm Jane."
"You, Jane, me," Broadhead began. Valentino stepped on his foot before he could finish the sentence.
"Lewis Pilot," the fat man nodded to them both. He was 40 and stubble-faced in a tank top, cargo shorts, and greasy ball cap reading Lou's Tire Warehouse.
"I'm the tour in charge of this here masterpiece of the cinematic art."
Thorpe beckoned Owl with a jerk of her head. They walked away a few yards to where a distracted-looking bald man was writing in a notebook. Behind him, two uniformed attendants were loading a stretcher into the back of an ambulance. Valentino had seen the action before, but had never gotten over the chill of watching a body bag being taken to the morgue. Lewis Pilot broke the awkward silence.
How are you gents fixed for radials?"
The lieutenant caught Valentino's eye and raised a hand. The pair excused themselves and joined the group.
"This is Dr. Berner, our ME," Owl said. "Tell them what you told us, Doc."
The medical examiner put away his notebook.
"We'll need to open him up to be sure," he said, "but on superficial examination, I suspect asphyxiation was the cause of death."
"Based on what?" Broadhead said. "He's a professor," Owl told Berner, as if that were an explanation.
"His fingernails were blue to begin with."
"Fentanyl poisoning can turn the skin blue," said the lieutenant.
"The skin, yes. It doesn't stop at the fingernails. There are other indications, but that one sticks out."
Valentine said. "He suffocated? How?"
Berner looked annoyed. "That's the investigator's specialty. My concern is cause of death."
Sergeant Thorpe asked when they could expect the autopsy report.
"When it's done."
But the medical man's pique evaporated in the presence of an attractive woman.
"I'll see if we can move it up. This isn't L.A. We don't get so many homicides. We treat them as routine."
Owl frowned.
"Homicide. That's an investigator's conclusion."
Thorpe smiled.
"Thank you, doctor."
He nodded, picked up his medical case from the ground, and left.
"Let's go inside," said Owl. "Don't touch anything. Print's team is on its way."
The trailer looked as if someone had been playing handball inside. Posters hung crooked. Books and jungle memorabilia lay on the floor. Owl saw Valentino's reaction.
"He was found slumped against the door. We thought he'd realized what the drugs were doing to him, jumped out of bed, bounced off walls, and collapsed while he was going for help. But if Berner's right, he was fighting to get out into fresh air."
It was impossible to tell if any of the items Valentino had seen were absent. He indicated the drawer that had contained the film reel in its canister. Jane Thorpe opened it carefully, preserving fingerprints. There was nothing inside but Bix's shiny revolver and the Tarzan versus the Zulu Zombies screenplay.
"Gun's a phony," Owl said. "Probably swiped from a prop department."
They went back outside. The door hung open, warped by whatever tool the stagehand had used to force it. Broadhead examined the lock without touching it.
"I lived in a trailer just like this my first year in California. It's a museum piece. Looks like it was locked from the outside."
The detectives took turns looking. The metal latch, bent from forcing, hadn't retracted into its slot. Owl pushed at it with the back of a hand. It didn't move.
"Well, maybe it got jammed when they broke in," Thorpe said.
"I hope not."
The others turned to Broadhead, busy stuffing his pipe. He shrugged.
"Everyone loves a locked room murder mystery."
"Speak for yourself, Professor," the lieutenant growled.
"What are you a professor of, anyway?"
medieval literature. I just sort of drifted into film.
Thank you, Professor. Jane Thorpe stepped in between Broadhead and her partner, whose chiseled face had darkened.
She shook hands again. Valentino thought hers loitered a moment in his, but he was too preoccupied to put any interpretation on it.
I gave Bix a deposit to hold the film, he told Owl. I'd be grateful if you'd let me know when it turns up.
Before the other could answer, an athletic-looking young man approached the group. He had frank blue eyes and wore a sweatshirt with the sleeves cut off. He was short, with a compact build of a jockey.
Colin Zawicki, Lieutenant. We spoke before. I'm the assistant director.
His voice was deep for his size, but not as deep as Owl's.
Lou wants to know when we can get back to filming. He thinks we can shoot the rest of Bix's scenes with a double.
Production's shut down until further notice.
Owl's tone fell just short of rage.
Can you tell him? I'm already his whipping boy. He blames me for the crane, as if I broke it myself.
Look at my face, Zawicki. What do you think?
The AD slunk away.
Owl blew air.
Ugh, movie people.
Valentino said, Oh, don't blame Hollywood, Lieutenant. The director sells tires and the assistant's a librarian. The Brass Gimbal, the film scholar's beanery of choice, was closed. They repaired to the Oracle, where a leak in the theater's poorly joined roof had forced the archivist to cancel a Marlene Dietrich festival and spread a tarp over some seats in the auditorium. They raided the refrigerator and the projection booth and sat in canvas director chairs with the leftovers. The space doubled as Valentino's apartment.
Mac and cheese,
Broadhead poked at a fork in the yellow stuff coagulating in his bowl.
Run out of fish sticks?
Next time I'll order from Chasen's. Valentino set aside his bowl untouched.
I don't see how you can eat it all.
It's an affirmation of life. Why do you think people bring casseroles to a wake? Anyway,
Darian Bix was a lost cause when King Brat got the axe and he started attending casting calls instead of prep school. The fentanyl would have gotten him sooner or later, and he'd be just another cautionary tale on E.T. This way, he joins the long roster of unsolved Hollywood mysteries. That's the A-list in Stiff City.
Well, I hope Fanta gets home soon. Whenever she's away, you revert to Savage.
Speaking of, stay away from Clarence Owl. He's like a summa cum laude grad stuck teaching in a second-rate college.
You want to rethink that Savage connection?
Balderdash. I was referring to his temperament, not his tribal affiliations, if any. Mediocre State U ain't Harvard, and Ventura County Sheriff's Department ain't LAPD, and he's just bitter enough to take it out on you.
He peered over the top of his bowl.
What about Jane Don't Call Me Sergeant Thorpe? You gonna ask her out?
Eat your fist sticks.
Don't I wish. I'm telling you, she's keen on the teen.
I'm 34, and I'm taken. Remember Harriet?
When I was 34, I'd been married 14 years. I was a widower for 25, and now I'm a married man again. If you won't play the field for yourself, you might at least allow me to live vicariously through you.
Valentino changed the subject.
What's your thought on Bix? How can a man die of suffocation in a drafty old trailer?
He can't. Therefore, by Cartesian reasoning, he's not dead.
Just for the sake of argument, let's say he is. How do you account for it?
I lack the lumber to build that frame of reference. Ask whoever locked him in that trailer.
Ruth's eyes shot lasers at Valentino when he came in the next morning. Her scarlet stiletto nails were poised on the keys of her computer.
What have you done this time?
Kyle Broadhead would have dismissed the question with a breezy good morning,
but the archivist lacked his experience and, most of all, the security of his academic tenure. Seniority had given the crusty secretary a kind of common law authority over everyone else in the building. He asked what she meant.
"There's another cop waiting for you in your office. You attract them like Dillinger."
Jane Thorpe sat behind his desk, in the only seat not engaged in storage. His stock of vintage hobby cards, original screenplays, and faded fan magazines had outgrown every other surface in the room. She looked fresher than he felt in a baby blue pullover, plaid skirt, and black patent leather shoes. He wondered where she carried her gun.
"Well, I can see why you and Bix got along," she said.
"Nah, I'm not really a collector. This is research. But I am sorry for the clutter."
"Oh, no, don't be. It's, well, homey. You should see my apartment."
Was that an invitation? He had to get Broadhead out of his skull. "Has something happened?"
"Well, the autopsy confirmed that Bix died of asphyxiation. In addition to the blue fingernails, cyanotic, Dr. Berner called it, it turned his blood and tissues cherry red. That's consistent with suffocation by cyanide or carbon monoxide poisoning."
He was poisoned.
"There were no traces of cyanide. Cyanosis is the general term for lack of oxygen in the blood. When Berner suggested monoxide, we suspected a defective gas or oil heater. But there was nothing like that in the trailer, and in any case, it was a warm night. That's not why I'm here, however. How much was that missing film worth?"
"Well, $10,000 or so. It's a specialized market."
Her brow puckered. "Well, that seems low. I've heard of movie artifacts going for six figures at auction. Dorothy's glass slippers from The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, lost films have been known to bring in as much if there's a particular demand. Tarzan the Apes isn't considered lost. My interest on behalf of UCLA is in the 3 minutes of undocumented footage Bix claimed was tacked on the end of the last reel.
People have been killed for much less, but we'd appreciate it if you'd take a look at the movie items we took from the trailer and give us a rough estimate of their value."
"I don't see as I could be any more help with that than I was yesterday. I didn't get much of a look at them when I met Bix."
"So you said, but a ballpark figure of what's there could give us an idea of the worth of what isn't. If it's substantial, and if profit was the killer's motive, it would narrow the search for a possible customer and who sold it to him. Assuming it exists, it's a straw worth grasping at."
"Well, wealthy collectors do tend to be particular," he considered.
"I'll be glad to do what I can. Are we going to police headquarters?"
She shook her head. "No, there's no space in our property room. Louis Pilot loaned us an outbuilding on the beet farm where the costumes and props are stored. There's room to spread out the collection."
"Is it okay if Professor Broadhead comes along? He's been evaluating Hollywood memorabilia since I was born."
She touched her chin.
"If you can get him to behave himself around the lieutenant, I'll do what I can on my end."
"All we can do is our best," she beamed.
"Then it's a date."
The car might have been the same one he and Broadhead had ridden in the day before. On the way, Jane Thorpe satisfied their curiosity about some details of the investigation. When the camera crane broke down the last time, Bix retired to his trailer, which was in darkness outside the shooting perimeter. They got it fixed an hour later, and Director Pilot sent Colin Zawicki, his assistant, to fetch the star.
"You know what happened then," Thorpe said. "The door was locked, but no one took notice at the time whether it was from the inside or the outside. It was a design flaw in that model. We consulted an expert.
You need a key to open it, but you can lock it just by twisting the button. Any prankster could come along and trap whoever's inside using only his fingers.
Valentino said, "You think someone locked him in, then pumped carbon monoxide inside?"
"There's a vent pipe on the roof. Our perp could have climbed to the top, carefully enough to avoid leaving a trace. We're just not sure what deadly agent was used. If it was monoxide, you'd have to drive a motor vehicle up to the trailer in order to run a hose over from the exhaust pipe, and no one heard a motor running." A tap on his shoulder made Valentino turn his head. Broadhead mouthed,
"Locked room murder mystery."
Tarzan and the Zulu Zombies no longer bore any resemblance to a legitimate movie set. Even during lulls in production, the ones Valentino was accustomed to visiting bustled with cinematographers maneuvering the lights, crews playing cards, directors in consultation with script supervisors, and all the other minutiae of art by committee making time. Here, most of the personnel had been laid off or reassigned to other projects along with most of the equipment. Police officers in uniform stood around, idly guarding the crime scene. Lieutenant Owl nodded to Valentino, ignored Broadhead, who ignored him in turn, consulted briefly with Thorpe, and led the party to a weather-beaten barn with a spavined roof. Louis Pilot and Colin Zawicki tagged along. Inside, Darian Bix's hoard was spread out on a plank floor. Klieg lights, microphone booms, and other movie apparatus shared space with barrels of fertilizer, insecticides, and sundry farm articles. "That's not a Tarzan item." Broadhead pounced on a spear-like staff and hoisted it. "John Hall used it to brain a caliph in Arabian Nights. Somebody saw Bix coming."
"Worth anything?" Owl said.
"About the same as Hall's career. He ended up as a baby photographer." Valentino shot him a warning look. The professor shrugged and sat down on an upended nail keg, planting the staff butt first on the floor like King Neptune. The archivist inventoried the items arranged at his feet. He consulted with Broadhead on some, then turned back to the detective. "The books and posters aren't in fine condition and might total a few thousand at auction, but that's all. Same with the props. Of course, I can't account for what might be missing, but it would take a thief with the eye of an expert to separate the wheat from the chaff." "In a dark trailer," Owl said, "subtracting time spent pumping poison inside, getting around that lock after locking it without a key, and sorting through the mess Bix made trying to escape? Wild goose chase. I told you 10 grand for that film reel is motive enough for murder."
"How did he get around that lock?" said Broadhead.
The lieutenant swung in his direction. Thorpe replied, diffusing the situation,
"We're still working on that."
Zawicki spoke. "Why complicate things? It was suicide. All this gas talk is bogus. The guy was a junkie. He o-dead, and that's all there is to it."
"Then what happened to the film?" Owl said.
"Valentino made it up. These college eggheads are always encouraging for donations. Some rich grad hears about buried treasure on the news and coughs up a wad of dough for the old alma mater. You found Bix's fentanyl. Why are we arguing about it?" A mouse skittered the length of an overhead rafter, its feet loud in the silence. Jane Thorpe broke it.
"Who told you we found fentanyl?"
The young man slid a hand up and down one of his muscular bare arms. I heard you talking." Owl glared at the film scholars.
"Did you tell him?"
Valentino shook his head. Broadhead thumped the butt of his staff on the floor, emphasizing the point.
"We knew what it was when we found it," Owl told Zawicki. "We don't noise that kind of thing around where witnesses can hear it.
I only brought it up when I spoke to the eggheads, and that was at UCLA. No one here knew about it except the man who put it there, and I'm starting to think it wasn't Darian Bix.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
But the assistant director's eyes slid sideways toward a wall half concealed by stacks of barrels. Thorpe pointed. "What's behind those?" she asked Lewis Pilot.
"Search me," said the director. "The owners of the place told us not to mess with their storage. That's all our stuff out here, where we can get to it."
Owl went to the door to summon officers from outside. Zwicky bolted, trying to get past him through the wide opening. He tripped over the Arabian Nights staff. By the time he fell sprawling to the floor, Broadhead had returned the staff to its vertical position. He kept his seat on the keg, calm as a toad. Jane Thorpe hauled the jockey-sized Zwicky to his feet, assisted by the first officer through the door. They held him by both arms while the others got busy dismantling the stacks. An officer grunted, lifted a white metal cylinder from the floor, and carried it by its leather harness out into the open. He placed it at Owl's feet with a clank. It was the size of a portable air compressor, with a 2-foot length of rubber hose attached to a nozzle on one end. "Hell on!" the lieutenant read aloud, the legend stenciled on the tank, pronouncing it with a long A. "Halon," Broadhead corrected him using a short A. "There's your murder weapon, detectives. An odorless, colorless gas with the single propriety of suppressing oxygen. Bix wouldn't have noticed it until he found himself choking for air." Owl asked how he knew so much about it. He seemed to want to hold Broadhead as an accomplice, despite his part in the suspect's apprehension. "I'm an egghead, remember? I've spent half my life in libraries. For a while, the gas replacement water pipes and fire extinguishing system to avoid damaging the books. Fire can't burn without oxygen. The EPA banned it finally because it depleted the ozone." "Libraries." Jane Thorpe drew out the word. Valentino nodded. Bix said it was an amateur operation all the way, run by a tire salesman and a librarian. Looks like Zwicky was already a thief when he came to work for the movies. "Good training for Hollywood," muttered Broadhead, but he didn't appear to be listening to himself. He'd gotten up from the nail keg and was looking down at it. "I didn't have to steal the gas," Zwicky said. "They were just as happy not to have to dispose of it themselves." He appeared to want to say more, but Owl cut him off to read him his rights. One of the uniforms frisked him and cuffed his wrists behind his back. "Here!" Broadhead had pried the lid off the keg. He started to reach inside, but Thorpe pushed past him and lifted out a flat metal canister with a hand sheathed in a handkerchief. Something rattled inside. "How'd you guess?" He grunted and dug out his pipe. "I may be a penniless academic, but I know when I'm sitting on $10,000. Lou Pilot shook his head. "A dead male lead and an AD on a murderer's row. I'm going back to the garage." Valentino came back from the men's room in the brass gimbal just as Broadhead punched the end button on the archivist's phone. "Did the Regents call?" "No, not yet, but I'm sure they'll come through for you. It's easier to give an honorary degree to a dead actor than a live failure. Your debt's paid."
"Then who?"
"Your girlfriend." He returned the phone. "I knew you wouldn't mind if I answered." "Zwicky confessed. After he shut off the gas, he crawled into the trailer through the outside storage compartment, which doesn't have a lock. He was built small enough to fit. It's a leaky old bus, and enough oxygen had slipped back in to make it safe. He planted the fentanyl to establish OD. Found the reel in the drawer, and it was the first place he looked. Bix should have listened to you. Zwicky hit it and the tank of gas in the barn, where he'd kept the gas all along. All in less than half an hour after he'd climbed onto the roof, he'd sabotaged the camera crane to give himself time.
How do you know about the film?
Overheard Bix telling you it was worth 10,000 times the $10 you paid him. I said the trailer leaked, and he was right outside. Remember, it was right after that he knocked and told Bix he was wanted back on the set.
But if he already had the weapon...
Killers are almost always amateurs. Thieves, slick ones like him, are pros. He was fired from a library back east for stealing computers and petty cash. They didn't report the missing Halon. Zwicky wasn't lying about that. They were grateful not to have to stand the expense of disposal. The barn on his next job was a handy place to stash it until he could find a customer for it. His whole take never amounted to as much as $10,000. What was the life of a washed-up former child star compared to a haul like that?
Valentino pushed aside his plate, untouched. You and I both know how far off he was in his arithmetic.
Well, granted, mostly. The sergeant called to tell you she's made arrangements with the state police lab in Sacramento to preserve Tarzan of the Apes in laboratory conditions until it's no longer needed for evidence. Owl wanted to stick it in the dusty evidence room downstairs, but as I'm sure you saw, this Jane's one beauty who knows how to tame the Lord of the Jungle. Incidentally, she gave me this to give to you. Excuse my scrawl.
He slid a napkin across the table.
Valentino didn't read the telephone number. He tore the napkin in pieces, crumpled them into a ball, and tossed them onto his plate.
Kyle, he said, you're the devil.
Well, call me Cupid. Broadhead stole a French fry from the plate. Then I've got the build for it.
Before we move to our next story, I have to apologize to the author for the first one. I mispronounced his last name. It's Estlemann. The next one comes out of the Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense. It's written by Stanley Cooperman. I know I've got that one right. And it's called Walk to the Station.
Those are not people. The fat man said, they are not people at all. If you think of them as people, you lose everything.
Peter struck a match and watched the small flame blink in the wind. He took the unlit cigarette from his mouth and tossed it away.
How easy is it, he said, for you to decide what to think?
The fat man shifted the black suitcase to his other hand and grimaced.
Oh, it isn't easy at all, he said, grunting with the effort in the late afternoon heat. But too many thoughts are unnecessary.
During the war, there wasn't time to think. The two men turned off Fifth Avenue and walked east along 42nd Street. They were carrying black overnight cases with tennis rackets strapped to them. The offices had started to empty, and they made their way awkwardly through the rush of bodies. Exhaust piled up from the taxis and buses, inching forward in crosstown traffic.
The eyes are most of it, Peter said. I find myself looking at a single pair of eyes, and very often the eyes look back.
Yes, the fat man said. I had that trouble at first. He hesitated. 13 years ago, it doesn't seem that long.
Of course, Peter said with heavy irony. In your case, however, they stopped looking back soon enough.
The trick, the fat man continued, ignoring the interruption, is to look at them as a group so that there are no complications. Once, when we were first putting them in the cars, an old man tripped and sprained his ankle. I rushed to help him before I knew what I was doing. I knew at the time that it was quite ridiculous, an obsolete impulse.
The fat man paused and smiled. If he had been shot, I wouldn't have bothered. As it was, it nearly cost me my job. They entered Grand Central Station and stood on the marble-surfaced steps, resting the black suitcases. There was no hurry. Peter looked down into the busy space before them. A goldfish bowl, he said.
That's right, you see. It becomes easier when you think like that.
They picked up their suitcases and went down the steps, becoming part of the station's movement. Peter stopped before a poster of a famous smiling face. Beneath the face, printed in large letters, was a request for civilian defense volunteers. Peter turned away from the picture. Do you think they really expect a warning from the sky? He asked. The fat man grinned thickly at him and wiped his forehead with a white handkerchief.
Would you like some ice cream? He said.
There are still a few minutes, and this heat. Oh, by all means, Peter said. The ice cream here is very good. He added with a glance at the fat man's waistline, and very rich.
Like the rest of the country, the fat man said, unperturbed, very rich indeed.
They entered a drugstore featuring a large soda fountain and sat at the chrome-trimmed counter. A young waitress came toward them. She was blonde and quick. Peter stared at the waitress while the fat man gave their order. A single drop of sweat glistened from her upper lip. For some reason, the drop fascinated Peter, and he stared at it so that the waitress blushed nervously as she turned away.
Do you like them that thin?
Peter ignored the question. He glanced down at the black suitcase resting against his leg. You are quite right, he said to the fat man.
About what?
During the war, Peter continued. We were on strafing assignment. The roads were full so that from the air the roads themselves seemed to be alive. They were moving. Our job was to kill the roads, to stop the movement. It was like shooting at a black snake. And there was nothing to think about.
Exactly, the fat man said, drumming his fingers on the counter.
He could already taste the coolness of the ice cream, and he waited impatiently. Did you know Novak? Peter asked suddenly. The fat man thought for a moment.
No. Who was he?
A mathematician, killed in 1944. He put it into a formula. The waitress returned with the ice cream, and the fat man began eating quickly, smacking his lips. Peter looked at him. I said he put it into a formula. The fat man stopped eating.
All right, he said. What was it?
He said this. The pity of death decreases in direct ratio to the progression of its mass.
Oh, very impressive, but I have been telling you the same thing, and without the big words.
The fat man wiped his forehead again. Eat your ice cream. When they left the drugstore, the fat man stopped, his features warped into sudden panic.
What is it?
Peter demanded, enjoying the tension. This job had been too easy. There was no danger, nothing to act against. Even when he had been strafing the roads, there had been a sense of exhilaration, of flying recklessly. Now he was simply a messenger, an errand boy. He welcomed the fat man's fear.
The lockers, I am unfamiliar with their location. We must call headquarters.
Idiot, Peter said sharply. We will do nothing of the sort. He looked around for a guard or a policeman.
Come with me and keep your mouth shut.
They approached a tall, middle-aged policeman who was standing next to a newsstand.
Pardon me, Peter said. Can you direct us to the nearest locker? We wish to check our bags there for a while.
Well, certainly, the policeman said and gave them instructions.
Going away for a trip, he added, eyeing the tennis racket strapped to the cases.
Yes, Peter said. The city is so uncomfortable this time of year.
Don't I know it? New York is hot enough to scorch asbestos. I was raised in a small town myself.
The policeman grinned ruefully at them. Peter began to tremble. He knew that he was talking to a dead man, and as he looked at the policeman's eyes, he saw them turning into steam, bubbling out of their sockets.
Thank you, he said very quickly.
When they were safely away, the fat man looked at Peter with approval.
Congratulations, he said. You did that very neatly.
Yeah, Peter said, neatly. They arrived at the lockers, and the fat man fumbled in his pocket. He finally produced two dimes and inserted them into the two slots. Peter opened the doors and placed the black suitcases in the lockers. He stepped back and looked at them while the fat man breathed heavily beside him. "Look at the clocks," the fat man said, motioning to a display in the window of a jewelry shop across the arcade. The clocks gave the time in Moscow, Paris, London, Chicago, and Los Angeles, and other cities.
"Look at them," the fat man repeated. "Each hour they show is different, yet each is the same. Agent 1 in Moscow, 2 in Paris, 3 in London."
He touched the locker gently, while his words marched in parade.
"The soldiers have quietly begun the battle."
"What battle?" Peter looked at the fat man with distaste. "Which soldiers?" He stared at the fat man's double-breasted suit and looked down at his own conservative suit, his black shoes and respectable tie. "The time for soldiers has passed. There are no more soldiers." The fat man shrugged and closed the doors. They walked rapidly away from the lockers. As they went to the exit, a small girl eating a large candy looked at Peter. She held her mother's dress while the woman spoke to a porter. The little girl looked solemnly at Peter as though she had seen him somewhere before. Peter felt himself drowning in the little girl's eyes. The fat man tugged at Peter impatiently.
"Let's go," he said. "There's still a long drive."
Peter turned away from the little girl, and they went to the exit. "I've never seen a jackpot before," the fat man said lightly. "It should be something to remember, providing," he added, winking at Peter, "we drive carefully." They hailed a taxi and gave the address of the parking lot where they had left their car. In the station, a loudspeaker announced the schedule to waiting travelers. At a newsstand, an old man argued about his change, and in the street, exhaust piled from the crosstown traffic.
Well, my friends, that's going to do it for the Mystery Hour this time. Thanks for tuning in. Keith Tyler asking you to join me again next time, would you please? Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.